funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the chances that humankind could withstand a catastrophe on a truly global scale? And are there things we can do to improve the odds? We Homo sapiens have already had some very close brushes with annihilation in our relatively brief time on the planet, somehow making it through famines, plagues, and resource competition with our Neanderthal cousins. But even these existential threats pale in comparison to the Earth's most significant extermination events, including one 250 million years ago that wiped out an estimated 95% of life forms on Earth. So could destruction on such a scale happen again, and what would it take for people to come out alive? Science writer Annalee Newitz is founding editor of the science website io9.com and has had articles published in Wired, Popular Science, and The Washington Post. Her new book is called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Annalee, welcome to Think.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So before we send people wandering away to pop a cyanide pill, we should let them know that the tone of this book is actually quite optimistic. And I wonder if you started your research expecting that.
Absolutely not. I am actually probably the most surprised of anyone that this book wound up having a happy ending because I started out just fascinated with the idea of disaster and, you know, partly fueled by my love for science fiction films. I really wanted to do a book where I could do a nonfiction version of a totally awesome disaster movie. And that was how I came across mass extinctions, which are, in fact, the worst disaster that can ever happen to creatures on the planet and the planet itself. And these are events where 75% or more of all species die out. So imagine out in the world, 75% less of all life. And these things happen pretty quickly in geological time. They take about 1 million years. So long from the perspective of our lifetimes, but very short in the Earth's lifetime. So once I started researching these, the thing that really shocked me was each time we have these disasters, we have survivors. And even in the most horrible times, life finds a way. And that was kind of the beginning of me starting to feel a little bit more optimistic about humanity's future.
And I guess, some of that desire for optimism explains why we tend to be so interested in fiction, in, you know, zombie movies and plague movies and movies where an asteroid hits the Earth and there's 72 hours to save everybody. We want a sense yeah. that there might be some way to control this or preserve, if not our own lives, the lives of our descendants.
I think that's true. I think that we tell different kinds of stories about the end of the world and about the end of humanity. And some of those are just focused on the disaster part, the part that I was interested in when I started this book, you know, where it's just like, dude, giant explosions. Awesome. And I don't want to say that that's bad, but I think that we have a kind of lack of stories right now, especially about how we will actually survive disasters. I think we're really focused on the disaster part, and that people are really in need of the counter narrative, which is here's actually how you can survive, you know, rationally by looking at how creatures have survived in history and duplicating what they've done, duplicating those survival strategies. So that was kind of what I wanted to do with this book, and what I wound up doing was saying, all right, great, we can talk about disaster, but what happens afterward? How do the survivors do it? And how can we do what they did so that humans survive another 1 million years as a species?
And none of this is related to, like, doomsday prepper activities. This is really about, in some ways, biomimicry of the species that have survived in the past.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. I think that the prepper perspective is useful because part of what we do need to be doing as a species and as, you know, citizens of cities and towns is thinking about what we would do if a disaster hit. For example, if a giant storm were, say, working its way across the country, how would we respond to that? How would we evacuate? What would we do to protect the maximum number of people? And I think that a lot of preppers are thinking through those problems, and I think that's great. But there's also a much larger species-level issue, and that is connected to the fact that all of the mass extinctions that have happened on the planet, and there have been five so far, have been caused by climate change. Mm-hmm. And climate change isn't something that you can fix just by having a good supply of canned goods in a safe underground shelter. That's a good start, but we need to be doing a lot more as a species to make sure that we don't head into a climate change-caused mass extinction.
I have to tell you, one big surprise for me that I suppose is logical, but I hadn't really thought about it in these terms before, is the fact that we owe existence as we know it today on Earth to some of these mass extinction events in the past.
That's right, because mass extinctions are events where huge parts of the ecosystem die out over these periods of time that seem quite long to us. And in the wake of those extinctions, new kinds of life forms are able to take over the now abandoned environments, and which makes it sound very neat and tidy. It's a lot messier than that.
Yeah.
But for example, the most recent mass extinction, which I think we all have heard about, when most of the dinosaurs were killed off by the sort of double whammy of supervolcanoes and a meteor strike 65 million years ago. When the dinosaurs started dying out, that allowed these little tiny furry shrews, who are our ancestors, the first most awesome mammals, who really did look sort of like cute little mice. So you know, think of that when you see a mouse or a shrew. But those creatures were able to go into new environments that had once been dominated by dinosaurs and then speciate, which is to say form new, you know, evolve into new species. And eventually that led to the evolution of early humans. Hmm. So we do actually owe our existence to these mass die-offs. But by the same token, I don't think we want to welcome a new mass die-off. I think we need to be thinking about preserving our environment now and not making way for a new group of creatures.
Yeah, the most astonishing one to think about is what you call the great, or what is called the great dying of the Permian period. This was 250
yeah.
million years ago?
Yep, 250 million years ago. And at the time, the planet was very different. Actually, all of the continents were pressed together into one mega continent called Pangaea. So you have to imagine a very, very different world. And at that time, the area which is now Siberia erupted in a supervolcano called an igneous province. And what happened was massive vents opened in the earth. So it wasn't like a big mountain that was kind of blowing up at the top. It was big, huge vents that were just oozing lava. And they did this for about 1,000 years. Hmm. So it wasn't just lava, but it was also all the contaminants, all the carbon and ash that was coming out of these vents that eventually caused what today we would call an extreme greenhouse event. The oceans became very acidic. The land became uninhabitable for lots of kinds of plants and animals. And eventually, 95% of all species died out on land and in the ocean, even killed insects, which is very unusual. Usually insects can survive anything. And it was, in fact, the most devastating mass extinction the planet has ever seen. And yet there were some survivors, and those survivors are part of our ancestry.
Emily, why are small creatures in a better position to survive these events than larger ones?
It's a good question because, of course, that's the dinosaur conundrum. Why did the big guys die out and the little fluffy shrews manage to make it through? And it's quite simply because usually these mass extinction events, you know, they're precipitated by some mega disaster like a volcano. But over time, they cause climate change. And the damage that climate change does is really a damage to the food supply. Hmm. And so you see, you know, huge die-offs among plants, which then kills off creatures who feed on them. And so quite simply, if you're small, you have a better chance of surviving because you need less fuel to live. And so oftentimes when you have a very large creature like a dinosaur or an elephant or a giraffe, these are the more vulnerable members of the ecosystem because they do require so much food. And oftentimes they have a very limited habitat range as well. And if that habitat changes, it's very difficult for them to survive.
So how, in terms of evolutionary activity, what had been underway before the Great Dying set in? Because it had been kind of a busy time in evolutionary terms, right?
Yeah, I mean, like many periods, in history, there were different kinds of animals that were evolving at a pretty rapid pace during the Permian period. You had a lot of creatures who eventually evolved into mammals and reptiles. So you hadn't seen a division yet between mammals and reptiles, which is kind of awesome because it means you can imagine things like pig lizards and stuff like that. And there were a lot of massive predators at the time. And some of those predators did make it through to the early Triassic, which is the period that follows the Permian. So you can imagine sort of like giant alligators. You know, Dimetrodon was one of the apex predators. Dimetrodon is a creature who most people think is a dinosaur. It looks like a giant lizard. And it has the big potato chip shaped sail on its back. It's kind of a famous icon. Anyway, Dimetrodon is pretty awesome because it probably ate sharks, which is how much cooler can you get than a giant animal eats sharks? So it was, you know, it was a time when there was lots and lots of trees on land, lots of land animals, lots of sea creatures. It was a very fecund time in the planet's history until those mega volcanoes in Siberia really shut the whole thing down.
So what happened in the oceans what has happened historically in the oceans when the temperature has changed a great deal?
So there's a couple of things that can happen in the Permian and likely in other climate change scenarios. What you would see is initially when you get a lot of particles in the atmosphere, sometimes you get a sudden onset of a cold period, maybe even an ice age, because the sun is being blocked by very reflective particles. And that can cause ocean levels to drop because water gets locked up into ice. And that destroys coastal life because the coasts are basically dried up. And that can be very devastating, especially in the Permian, because there was a lot of life living in the coastal areas. But then as things begin to heat up again, as you see more and more greenhouse gases entering the atmosphere, things warm up, which means all of those ice packs melt and ocean levels rise. But what happens is you'd think like, okay, yay, the ocean levels are rising again. That's good. But unfortunately, because you have so much carbon in the environment, that carbon starts getting into the ocean water, especially on the surface of the ocean, which is, again, where a lot of creatures live. And that creates carbonic acid. Yay. And it's basically you get acidification of the water. And it's not like the water becomes acid like alien blood. You dip your hand in and it melts off. But what does happen is many creatures who depend on making their shells or bones out of calcium aren't able to do that anymore because calcium is no longer available in the environment. And so you get basically what people see now with ocean acidification, where you see coral reefs that are kind of rotting away. You see shellfish that are unable to reproduce successfully because they just can't build their bodies, which is part of what happens in an extinction event like this. And it's happened. Ocean acidification has been a huge part of mass extinctions pretty much every time we've had one. And in the Permian, things got so bad that there were regions of the ocean that are called anoxic zones, which means that all of the oxygen had been leached out of that part of the ocean, which left nothing to breathe.
My guest is Anna Lee Newitz. She is founding editor of the website for science, io9.com. Her new book is called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. You can join the conversation now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science writer Annalee Newitz, founding editor of the website io9.com and author of the new book Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. Okay, so Annalee, you mentioned ocean acidification. You mentioned rapid changes in temperature. Those conditions that correspond to massive extinction events in the past sure sound a lot like the 21st century.
They do, don't they? I mean, and one of the reasons why environmental scientists today are concerned that we may be in the early stages of a sixth mass extinction come from the fact that we know historically that these kinds of climate change events do cause mass extinctions. And in addition, we do have evidence that over about the past 200 years, during the time when we've actually been keeping records of life forms and extinctions, that there has been an elevated rate of extinction among animals. So we think that we are seeing the early stages of a kind of mounting number of creatures going extinct. Now, again, these events take, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, so we can't be certain. But what we can say is, looking back at geological time, there's a lot of warning signs, and it's not too late for us to start intervening and trying to prevent a full-scale mass extinction event.
So, you know, with 7 billion humans on the planet right now, it seems like a foregone conclusion that, of course, we would make it. But in fact, you remind us here that our species has already survived some incredibly close calls. Can you talk about some of them?
Yeah, for sure. There have been many times in human history, including going back to fairly early days in our evolution, where humans have basically dodged the bullet. And one of those times was certainly early in our evolution, about, you know, 80,000 years ago, when humans were first when Homo sapiens was first leaving Africa. And there's evidence that at that time, there was some kind of event, possibly a volcano, possibly something else, that may have thinned out the population and may have caused that massive exodus from Africa. And we can't be sure. But what we do know is that when humans left Africa, when early humans began heading into Europe and Asia, that they were very successful and that that was sort of our first survival moment. It was a really good choice for us to leave and start exploring new environments. And that's, of course, when we encountered Neanderthals and Denisovans and possibly Homo erectus, who were all other humans who were already who'd already left Africa long ago. And there's a lot of evidence now that we actually assimilated with them and that we had babies with them. But there have been other more recent challenges to Homo sapiens in the form of plagues, going all the way back to, in Europe, the 14th century plagues, and, of course, more modern-day plagues, and famines as well. And famines often accompany plagues in various ways. But we've managed to make it through even these terrible events that in some cases, in the case of the bubonic plague in the Middle Ages, that event may have killed up to 50% of people in any given region where it hit, which is huge. I mean, we know that in London during the first wave of the Black Death, 50% of the population did die. And, you know, that's when you think about that happening today, like imagine if 50% of your city died, it would feel like the apocalypse. It would feel like Homo sapiens is reaching an end. But in fact, that's not what happened. And we wound up rebuilding our civilizations to be much better and more robust against these kinds of disasters. So we have made it, but there have been some pretty darn tough times. You know, survival is not for the faint of heart. It's not going to be a pathway of flowers and rainbows and unicorns. I mean, if it is, that's great, but
it would be a much more exciting discussion. Yeah. But unfortunately, probably not going to happen. So, Annalie, talk about this because our earliest ancestors may have scattered, as you say, to find food to get away from whatever problems they were experiencing at the birth of human civilization in Africa, and then getting through things like plagues before we had modern medicine and science was really just a matter of, was it good luck? Were people actually doing things proactively to keep themselves healthy that worked on occasion?
Well, certainly during the Middle Ages, one of the things that kept people healthy was having enough money to eat. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of evidence now that the numbers we see in the first wave of Black Death really came from people who were peasants who just didn't have enough food. There had been waves of starvation in England at that time where we have good records. And so people who had a good diet tended to be able to throw off the infection. People who isolated themselves could also do that. So there were some, you know, vague notions of how to protect ourselves, but it really wasn't until modern medicine and modern epidemiology, which is the study of how diseases spread in a population, it really wasn't until, you know, within the last, say, 200 years that we really began to understand how to rationally combat a pandemic in the process of unfolding. Beforehand, it was a bit of luck, a bit of common sense, but, you know, the numbers were staggeringly huge. The death numbers were staggeringly huge because we didn't have a systematic way of dealing with it.
And in our recent history, we have had some astonishing success with figuring out where these pandemics come from and how we might contain them.
It's true. And I think we're only going to get better at it. One of the really encouraging signs is that we do now have the ability to use computers to simulate how an epidemic will unfold. And, you know, including things like where people's travel is likely to take them and what populations are likely to spread epidemic diseases more quickly than others. And it should be no surprise to anyone who has children that children are really the population that spreads an epidemic disease the fastest. They're just germy little creatures. And so we know that if a pandemic is coming, that it's very, very important to make sure that we vaccinate kids because vaccinating a kid is like vaccinating 10 adults, basically. Hmm. It's really a social good to make sure that this population can't spread a disease. And of course, we know also that many of the areas where diseases tend to break out or where epidemic strains tend to originate, often in the developing world, are also places that we should be targeting with vaccines. So ideally, what you want to see are children in the developing world getting first access and best access to vaccines. Of course, if it's too late, then you're looking at trying to use antivirals or other therapies to prevent a disease that's already spreading. So we do know all that stuff. And the big question is, how do we get the science that we have and the information that we have into a decent social policy or into the public's mind as a way of combating this stuff? Because even in the United States, we have these debates over vaccines and whether they're bad or not. And to me, that's just kind of terrifying because we actually do know that vaccines prevent pandemics and people are sort of arguing over whether that's a good idea. Obviously, it's a good idea. We need to work together as a civilization to stop mass death among us, and vaccines are one really good way to do it.
So a situation like a pandemic is absolutely terrifying to consider, but it's one that I think most people can get their minds around. But there are any number of other things that could happen to us, things that might come from outer space, an asteroid strike or massive radiation. And now we have at least some knowledge and some technology that might allow us to keep a significant number of people alive.
It's true. Short of something like a super. So if there is a supernova that goes off in our neighborhood and fries the atmosphere off with gamma radiation, it's going to be tough times. Even in that case, though, I would like to say that even in that case, we might get some warning. We might get a few minutes of warning. And if you'd like to be protected against radiation, all you really need is a couple of feet of rock between you and the radiation source. So if enough people can get underground quickly, and I know that they will, we can even survive something insane like that. And there's evidence that in Earth's history, animals did survive a gamma radiation accident. Let's call it an accident. Someone else might call it a supernova. But there are other more realistic and more common disasters that come from space, such as meteorites. We just saw one blow up over Russia, and luckily very few people were harmed. Mostly there was property damage. And asteroids, you know, zoom around all the time in our solar system neighborhood. Comets zoom around all the time. And luckily, we do have programs in place now, such as NASA's Near Earth Object Program. And the ESA has a similar program where we use space telescopes to identify all of the rocks that are potentially in a intercept course with Earth. So it's basically, what are the rocks that pass through our neighborhood, our space neighborhood? And we've cataloged hundreds of these. And, you know, by many estimates, we've probably cataloged over 95% of the objects that are out there that might pose a danger to us. So that's incredibly good news, because if we are tracking those objects, and of course, we're continuing to look for more, that means that if there is a dangerous asteroid that's on an intercept course with Earth, we're likely to see it many years before it's going to hit us. And if we can catch it, you know, 10 years out or 20 years out, then it's going to be a pretty simple matter to knock it off course and get it out of the way. So once that happens, once we see one, the next step will be to build a probe that can actually push it out of the way. Again, we have the technology now. We've sent probes to the asteroid belt. We can do it. It's just going to be a matter of mobilizing a bunch of nations and companies to put those probes together and knock those rocks out of our path.
Have we practiced this on anything that is not an imminent threat?
Actually, yeah. We have. We shot a giant slug of nickel into a comet and observed the damage and, you know, looked at how that would happen with one of our probes quite recently in the past few years. So we do know that it's possible to intercept a moving object. This was not a comet that was in any way any danger. It was just kind of like, hey, let's
try this,
see
out
what happens. Yeah, and it wasn't even, I should say, like the goal of the experiment was not just, you know, let's see if we can move this guy around. It was also to kick up dust and analyze the content of the comet. But yeah, I mean, we have the technology to create probes that can intercept a moving object and shoot it with something that will perturb its pathway. And the farther away an object is from us, the easier it is to do that. Because if it's 20 years out, even a slight push will actually, in, you know, in 20 years, cause it to be passing very, very far away from the Earth. So the goal is to catch it as far away as we can so that it doesn't take a lot of energy to move it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Maggie in Coppell. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, how are you? Hi. Yes. I am just curious to find out why our president or current or future presidents haven't talked about NASA already has people, you know, on different planets, and so does other of our countries. So I don't believe that there will be an extension of human life or race. So at what point in time do we start asking when can these spaceships or ships be made to help more people survive a disaster?
Well, Maggie, you're asking the right woman here. Annalee?
So I should just say that, sadly, NASA does not have any humans on other planets yet. That would be great. We have put humans on the moon, but we haven't actually as far as I know.
Nor have any other countries, we should point out.
Yes, nor have any other countries, unless there's like a super awesome secret program going on, which would be very cool. Ultimately, the long-term goal for human survival, and when I say long-term, I do mean thousands of year survival, should be to get humans living on other planets or even living on really huge space stations, big Halo worlds, like from the video game Halo, for those of you who have played that. And the idea is that really, you know, first of all, humans are great explorers. And so I think that this is an ideal goal for us. But also the planet is dangerous. You know, there really is the possibility of some kind of disaster coming from space, or you know, more supervolcanoes erupting and really making the planet unlivable. And so before that happens, I think we should be planning on eventually building cities on other worlds. A lot's going to have to happen before that, though. Let's keep in mind that we need space programs, we need to be studying this stuff, but there's a lot of technologies we're going to have to invent to make it possible for us to live on other worlds. Some of those technologies will involve maybe things like terraforming, which is creating, which is basically engineering the geology of another planet to make it more Earth-like. Or it could also mean re-engineering the biology of humans to adapt to living on another world. So we might get technological implants to allow our lungs to extract oxygen from the atmosphere on another world. Or we might actually change our biology so that we are able to live in a methane-based atmosphere like on Titan, Saturn's moon that has a very nice atmosphere. And so we really have to think very long term on this stuff. We have to be thinking, you know, this is going to happen maybe in 1,000 years. And when it does, things are going to be really different. And living in space will probably not look like Star Trek. It'll probably look a lot weirder than that. And humans may be very, very different by the time that happens.
My guest this hour is Annalee Newitz. She's founding editor of the science website io9.com, and she writes for additional publications as well, including Wired and Popular Science. Her new book is called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. If you want to be part of this conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with science writer Annalee Newitz. Her new book is called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Annalee, assuming that we stay here in a troubled future, how different might our cities look?
Well, I think that as we're looking ahead and keeping in mind that a lot of the fuel that we depend on now is a finite resource, for example, I think that our cities are likely to become closer and closer to being carbon neutral, because it's absolutely imperative for us to build sustainably in order to have food, basically, because as I was saying before, one of the problems with climate change that causes mass extinction is that we see famines developing because habitats where food grows change and the food can't grow there anymore. So to the extent that we want to maintain our environment, maintain our food supply, I think we're going to see much more emphasis on building cities that behave like part of the ecosystems that they exist in. And there's already a lot of architects and designers and synthetic biologists and material scientists who are thinking about this stuff and thinking about how do we redesign our cities? How do we retrofit them? How do we build new cities that can be eventually carbon negative, maybe even not just carbon neutral? And some of this is going to involve really simple things like having urban farming, which means replacing a lot of suburban development with farms. But some of it is going to be, it sounds almost science fictional. It'll be making buildings out of materials that can heal themselves, either materials that are biomimetic or actually made with biology.
So there are ways to sort of program, say, plant material to grow into something like a building?
There could be one day. Certainly, we haven't reached the point yet where we can plant a seed and grow a building. Although in the course of researching this book, I did talk to a lot of architects about this who do imagine that, who say, like, yeah, one day this could really be the case. But in the near future, say in the next 50 years or 100 years, I think what we're going to see is more like what are now being called self-healing materials or smart materials, which are materials that are they're actually sometimes made with bacteria, for example, like self-healing concrete is a really good example of that. And what this is a kind of concrete that you could build with a bridge or a building. And if there is structural damage to it, say from a disaster or just from regular wear and tear, you could use this self-healing concrete to actually grow those cracks back together again. And, you know, what happens is you have bacteria that is genetically engineered to basically extrude epoxies or glues and fill in the crack and then die. So this is a very important part of building biology is it needs to be able to die when it's done. And that's a very big part of synthetic biology is thinking about how to make that happen. But so you might end up seeing cities that have where the surfaces of buildings and bridges might look sort of puckered and scarred because you would have it healing itself over time. And, you know, this makes the building safer from damage, but also more sustainable. And there's a lot of other self-healing materials that are nearing marketability at this point. Like they're actually going on the market as things like sealants for ship hulls. There's actually sealants you can use that will, if you expose them to a little heat, just close right up. And so you don't need to, you know, strip the hull and fix it that way. So again, it's very sustainable. It's a way of creating large pieces of infrastructure that behave like organisms. And I think that's the first step toward having a living city, and that over time, we may see much more dramatic developments like building with algae, for example. Algae is really fun for synthetic biology. There's lots of things you can do with it. You can use it as fuel, which is great. But you might also be able to tweak it genetically to do things like water filtration or even climate control. And maybe one day we can use algae as lighting because a lot of types of algae can glow at night. So instead of burning your fossil fuel and having a light bulb, you might just have this gentle green algae glow in your house. Which may sound kind of gross to some people.
Bacterial lighting. I like it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's quite a beautiful color. But I think, again, you know, this is why it has to be a slow process, is that, you know, over time, this will seem really normal. But to us, it sounds completely bizarre, like I'm lighting my house with bacteria. But, you know, in the future, that may be the very best way to do it because we just won't have fossil fuels available to us anymore. And we're going to have to change.
Well, and again, that comes back to, you know, the second part of your book, which is that we're pretty adaptable, remarkably adaptable, given the sense that we feel like we don't like change. But over time, we've been able to really roll with a lot of punches.
We really have. And I think, you know, it's the difference between looking at humans in terms of one lifetime, where any individual human in their, you know, 80 or 90 year lifespan is probably pretty grumpy about change, especially like if it means having to buy like a new phone or a new computer, it's really annoying. But over the long term, when you look at generational change, it's quite rapid. And, you know, cities have changed dramatically over the past 200 years, just radically. I mean, now the vast majority or the majority of humans live in cities, over 50%. And those numbers are predicted to climb over the next 50 years. And cities really are becoming much more like hives or organisms, I think in a positive way, because they become economically productive. They become places where people do a lot of scientific and cultural innovation. And I think that's why when we think about changing our behavior to prevent more climate change from happening, we really do need to think about how we would build our cities and how we would transform them to be dependent on new kinds of energy. Even if, you know, just in the short term, in our short, tiny lifespans, that means bringing more solar energy into the cities. One of the things I'm really interested in this book is how solar power is actually one of the most ancient forms of adaptability and survivability in species on the planet. Cyanobacteria, who are also known as blue-green algae, one of the oldest life forms on the planet. They've survived every mass extinction. And here's why. Because they're photosynthetic. They use solar energy so they can live anywhere. They can survive almost anything because they're dependent on this super great energy source. And so I think now that humans have figured out how to do that too, that it gives us yet another tool in our survival toolbox. Solar power is a tried and true method of surviving.
That's sort of a hopeful idea, too. As long as the sun holds out, we've got a shot.
Right. So we've got a billion years of sun. So we've got some time.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Tom in Grand Prairie. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Should I go ahead?
Yes, please.
Yes. Well, your guest has mentioned the sixth extinction, and in Leakey's book, he says that humans are the cause of the sixth extinction from habitat destruction and from chemicals and from taking plants from one part of the world and introducing them into another part. So I assume that your guest is an optimist and thinks that a man will educate himself and that this is not a problem.
What do you think, Annalie?
Well, first of all, I would say Richard Leakey's book on the sixth extinction is indispensable reading. It's really fascinating. And he's absolutely right that humans have very likely played a role in, if we are in a sixth mass extinction, and evidence suggests we may be, humans definitely. Burning fossil fuels is kind of like we set off our own supervolcano. We released a lot of carbon into the environment. And, you know, we didn't realize for a really long time what kinds of damage we were doing. And we were burning that volcano for hundreds of years before we figured out, oops, this might not have been the best idea. And I think that humans have altered the climate. We have altered habitats. We have been responsible for extinctions. But now that we have figured out our role in it, I think we are going to figure out a way to remediate the damage. And we may not be able to repair all the damage, and we can't bring back the extinct species, although there is a group who's trying to de-extinct some of them, and you know, good luck to them. But I think that we can, through projects like making our cities carbon negative, carbon neutral, through reforming farming practices and being more mindful about invasive species, for example, and really understanding how ecosystems work fundamentally can help us get out of the predicament that we've put not just ourselves, but the entire planet in. And we have to start thinking about the fact that humans are not super special creatures that aren't part of ecosystems. We actually are fundamentally a part of an ecosystem. And the only way we can survive is to preserve that ecosystem because it gives us food and it gives us an environment that's comfortable. And so I think once we really do have the science and engineering to really understand how that works, that it's really going to be a short time before we start implementing changes that could, over time, lead to a very comfortable climate for us and our ecosystems. And like I said, I think solar power is a great early example of humans trying to do that.
We haven't talked much this hour about invasive species, but these are starting to be recognized as a problem here in Texas, in other parts of the country, in other parts of the world. How did these become such a problem and start to really interfere with ecosystems?
Well, in our time, invasive species are basically entirely humans' fault. And also, we're an invasive species. I mean, we go into environments and kind of take over. And an invasive species is basically what biologists would call a generalist species. And that means it's a species that can find food and environments that are comfortable anywhere. It can adapt to lots of places. And that's opposed to a specialist species, which depends on only certain kinds of food and can only live in certain areas. And the problem happens when your generalist species comes into an area with a lot of specialists and invades the area, takes over all of the ecological niches, and then there's not enough food for those specialists. And the specialists can't move next door because they're specialists. They have to have the food and that environment right there. They're not generalists. And so that's really how ecosystems get out of balance when you have an invasive species like kudzu. Kudzu is like, yay, I can live anywhere. And then the local grasses and the local greenery can't compete for the resources that the kudzu is taking. And so it's very important now that we understand this and we understand which species are generalists that can take over in that way, that we really restrict how we move species around. I think Australia has also learned this lesson with a lot of animals that were introduced that have taken over there. And, you know, again, this is something that going forward, I think environmental engineers are going to be very aware of, and people who are, you know, planning land use are going to be aware of. But we haven't been aware of it very long. And so there has been a lot of damage that's been done.
How much thought do we need to give to preserving human culture and human knowledge in the event of a really unexpected sort of overnight catastrophe that would even say decimate the population?
Mm-hmm. The gamma ray burst from the supernova kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge part of humanity is our body of knowledge. And I think it's one of our greatest tools. And so absolutely, it's going to be important for us if there is a kind of collapse of our population to be thinking about how we would preserve that. And there are different groups, many of them on the internet, thinking about what knowledge we would need to restart civilization. It's not a great idea to be storing all of your information in the cloud if you're worried about a disaster, you know, unless you're kind of like holed up in a server farm. So a lot of the information is going to need to come from books. It's going to need to come from stuff that's been stored offline. And I think because we do have so many actual physical backups of stuff that is on the internet, we're going to be okay in terms of having that information. It's just going to be a matter of making sure that everyone has access to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason why in San Francisco, after the big quake in 1906, a lot of people met at the Mechanics Institute, which was a library for engineers, because they wanted access to that data. So maybe I'll see you there again.
The new book by Annalee Newitz is called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Annalee, such fascinating stuff to think about. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.